Hey, good morning, everybody, and sorry for the delay on getting Spaces up this morning. It would not load for me. We're having a little bit of technical issues. Again, same with the music for the intro, so I do apologize about that. And so we'll just start this off with a cold intro, and welcome to Monday morning. This is episode 82. We're going to be having a special guest join us today. Matthew Pines will be joining the space. So I'm going to really look forward to talking to him, asking him questions about what's going on with the drones, his takes, if they're alien or if they're domestic or if they're foreign. So it'll be a great conversation. Also, because he works with the Bitcoin Policy Institute, pick his brain a little bit on how he feels with the new upcoming administration and possibly the creation of or an executive order with the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve. So I see Matthew in the audience right now, so bring him up on stage. So make sure everyone, let's just give him a big welcome to the Bitcoin veterans. So Matthew, good morning, sir. I want to thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me.
I apologize. I sent you the link over the weekend, but it wasn't working correctly for us, so I had to create a new space. So I apologize for any confusion with that.
Oh, all good.
Awesome. So in case anyone is unfamiliar with Matthew, he's an consultant specializing in cybersecurity, geopolitical risk, and national security, and currently serves as the Director of Intelligence at Sentinel One Strategic Advisory Group, where you lead integrated geopolitical advisory, tech security, and business strategy solutions. You also work as the head of strategy at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, where you conduct research to help policymakers understand the geopolitical and national security implications of Bitcoin and other emergency technologies. Did I miss anything with that, Matthew?
No, it's a mouthful. Thanks, man.
No, you have a lot of titles, and so a little bit of me. I've been sitting on the sidelines for the last 4 years, so I just recently was able to kind of get involved and do things. So I've been a huge fan of yours, specifically with your UAP conversations. The little kid in me still wants to believe that there is alien life form out there. So that was kind of the main reason bringing you on today's space, was to get your take of what is going on the East Coast with all the drones. So if you can kind of tell us anything, what you may think it is, and kind of go from there.
Yeah, so obviously this most recent sort of flap has drawn, you know, has sort of fully entered the zeitgeist, right? Everyone is obviously very much thinking about it. But this issue of unidentified objects, incursions over restricted airspace has been going on for a while. And in particular, you know, in the past year or so, there's been pretty high profile incidents, the Langley Air Force Base issues in December of 2023, kind of the most recent high profile incidents. That those, you know, were extremely significant for the U.S. government. You know, that was elevated to the highest highest levels in the U.S. government. That was a multi-week incident. You know, they never really ran it down as to exactly what or who was responsible for those incursions. They had to move an entire you know, essentially interception squadron, out of that Air Force base. And so this has been an issue. This isn't just like this New Jersey stuff is like, all of a sudden coming out of, nowhere. Then you've had, other sort of maybe less reported incidents over military facilities and other sensitive sites across the country, including in the Southwest and in some facilities on the West Coast. And then more recently, you've had a whole spate of mysterious incursions and disruptions to RAF bases in the United Kingdom, about four in particular, that were, you know, essentially experiencing something very similar to what Langley Air Force Base had experienced. And the British government, in concert with American, you know, assets, deployed special forces soldiers and all their, you know, most sensitive and capable counter UAS equipment to try to, assess what was going on and to try to, you know, stop those incursions. They went on for several weeks. I, you know, saw that they may have even just restarted again. So these New Jersey incidents, obviously, they also correlated with similar reports over military facilities like Picatinny Arsenal, some of the other military bases. And just on Friday night, you saw incursions, you know, heavy UAS activity that forced Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to shut down their entire airspace. And they actually, you know, basically there's a audio clip of them instructing a medevac transport to essentially give, like, last permission to fly over their airspace before they, quote, sanitized it, as their security forces were attempting to respond to what they called heavy UAS activity. There have been similar reports of incursions over military facilities in Germany, particular Ramstein, as well as drone activity over, or a suspected drone activity, quote, drone activity over different sort of military adjacent facilities like Rheinmetall, which is a major defense sort of supplier. So there's a lot of activity that you could sort of put under the rubric of, quote, drones or UAS or UAP that is occurring over sensitive military facilities for a while now. This has been a pattern. Pattern's ongoing. The New Jersey, like, civilian sightings, I think, were a particularly sort of new phenomenon relative to that sort of recent trajectory. But if you actually look in history, like, there have been, you know, a variety of what you would call, like, UFO flaps throughout the 20th century. You know, the some of the more famous ones, like 1952 over D.C., you had kind of objects fly over the Capitol for multiple days. It triggered, you know, probably the most significant press conference that the military had held since World War II. You know, they brought out all the big brass. They had to explain to reporters what was going on. And so this is, you know, this is like the modern version of that sort of historical phenomenon that now, of course, given the fact that we have drones as commercial and civilian and military use proliferating in a variety of different applications, and we have smartphones, and we have people, you know, maybe not used to looking at the sky, you have a much more noisy information environment, right? So that's kind of like me setting maybe like the context for this, right? Folks, you know, trying to assess what's really happening here. It's a real struggle. It's kind of an information soup, and most of it's not edible. And I would also say, you know, the government has not exactly helped matters out. The sort of strategic communications coming out of the White House, you know, Kirby, et cetera, have not helped things. And I think you've seen sort of a crescendo of local officials, you know, now reaching the point of, you know, senior senators essentially holding press conferences stating that they have no idea what's going on, and they're sort of demanding answers from the White House and the Pentagon. And so it's not great, not great along many different dimensions. But yeah, that's, I guess I'll stop there. You know, you can feel free to pull the thread on any of that stuff.
Well, yeah, so thank you for that. And you're right, there's a ton of threads to pull from with that. I guess the skeptic in me is, or you could say conspiracy theorist, is when you start getting different government agencies giving different reports or different views on something, I immediately think that they know what it is and they're just trying to cause confusion. So I guess with all of the drone activity or UAP, however you want to classify it, why haven't we been able to intercept one of them, or why are we unwilling to?
I don't have a good answer for you, man. It's, you know, it's either we're unable to or unwilling to, right? Right. And, I suspect in, given the diversity of different locations and the way these facilities work is that, you know, some have their own endogenous security forces with, a variety of different capabilities, right? So there's been reports over, you know, that have come out of the Langley incident where they attempted to shoot, you know, these things down with the capabilities they had on site, which were quite limited. I think the ones they were using were like drone busters, which are sort of handheld anti-drone sort of electronic disruption systems that are meant to sort of disrupt the ground controller link to the UAS platform and to potentially even take it over or sort of inject commands that force it to land. There's a variety of different, you know, software-based kind of computer network attack-based counter UAS systems that are available that have been tested against a wide swath of different commercial as well as just sort of general protocols. And so those failed to work in that particular case in Langley. you know, the individuals, you know, I think it was this, whatever, the security squadron for Langley, you know, they wrote up their reports. Essentially, they saw these objects, these lights, essentially, you know, continually encouraging, you know, going over the base. They had to, you know, shut down flight operations. They had to, move the entire squadron. So they were, you know, desperate essentially to try to do what they could, and everything they tried, you know, and you can read the, like the individual, you know, frontline, security, officers kind of writing their reports. It just wasn't working, right? So that's just one example, right? Back in Langley in December 2023, in the current context in New Jersey, right? When it's just over a suburban backyard, there's nothing illegal about it. You know, technically, if it's, you know, within whatever 400 feet, if it's line of sight, certain class, I think it's class G airspace, there's no legal, violation occurring. And you know, actually shooting down a drone, is quite a, risky act, right? Even a very small, you know, like 1 pound drone falling from several hundred feet can kill somebody. So, you know, this has been a long-standing topic in law enforcement, FBI, if it's just, you know, typical UAS platforms. You know, back in 2016, I led an assessment for DHS that was looking at counter UAS requirements and systems, capabilities to protect covered assets. And so this was something that was designated in law. Section 124N, sort of authorities were given to the Secretary of Homeland Security as well as the Attorney General to delegate to the FBI to basically use counter UAS systems over, quote, covered assets, and they designated those. And so this includes everything from, you know, major airports, major national security special events like Super Bowl, State of the Union, et cetera. It includes protecting, you know, high-risk facilities, critical infrastructure, et cetera. And it involved, you know, essentially site-specific assessments of the risk and, you know, recommendations on particular platforms. And I'll just say, like, back then it was not an easy solution. I, you know, it seems like not much progress has been made since then. And so that's just is like, just in the pure realm of like UAS, right? So there's a lot going on in this particular spate of incidents, right? That's all kind of somewhat conflated together. And I think, you know, it is interesting that like the first reaction by political officials is basically, you know, to say, we don't have any idea what's really going on. And so this is why you need to pass like more laws to allow us to spend more money on fancy drone equipment and, or counter drone equipment and put in place more surveillance, you know, authorities, right? And so I'm usually very hesitant to allow just kind of a particular crisis incident to slip into giving the government just blanket more authorities, as opposed to just actually using your existing authorities to answer basic questions, and not just, you know, constantly kind of, try to justify the expansion of, you know, surveillance. So I have sympathy for the local law enforcement here, which are, you know, getting questions from their neighbors and their mayors about what, you know, what's going on, like, why can't you do anything? And I think people are actually, you know, seeing real things. I think now that it's been going on for multiple weeks, people are primed to look up at the sky, and most folks don't do that very often. And so there's, you know, not, I think, a good baseline assessment in those people's heads of like what's unusual, right, to see, like, in terms of a light in the sky and, you know, like landing patterns for local airports, helicopters at night, especially in sort of low visibility conditions, Starlink. So I think you're going to see, you know, a vast amount of just noise in social media videos and people's like, you know, firsthand accounts of what they see. But it's very clear if you just sort of abstract all the civilian reporting, the incursions over military facilities, the shutting down of restricted airspace, reports from FBI and sheriff's offices and Coast Guard, you know, boats of, you know, basically having close encounters with these objects. That is a much harder thing to just like wave away as misidentifications or sort of the snowball of sort of mass hysteria that now we're sort of seeing sort of flood the zone. So I think there is a serious issue at the core of this that's now surrounded by a lot of noise and a lot of speculation and a lot of sort of, you know, social media, hype and exaggeration. And you see that unfortunately, like these narratives, you know, quickly take off, right? Like, you know, there's a loose nuke, right? That the government is keeping a secret and, you know, very serious, you know, quote, serious people with a lot of followers were sort of amplifying that. And I'll just say that's just an absurd theory. We can dig into that. But like, we're now this in this low information zone where all sorts of crazy, you know, quote unquote crazy ideas can sort of take off and instill a lot of fear in the population. So if I'm a U.S. adversary, this is quite, you know, an opportune moment. So I could also imagine that, like, you know, folks might be trying to take advantage of the chaos and do things under the radar, quote unquote, that they might otherwise not have decided to do, because our security forces are stretched, our political attention is distracted in all these other directions. And so it might be an opportunity for adversaries to sort of, take advantage, right? And as well as people that just want to, you know, get a kick out of, triggering, some sort of, you know, hoax. So there's, whenever you have an incident like this, just gets start off, usually starts off with like a very legitimate, you know, concrete series of observations of quite disruptive and concerning activity. And now you've reached a point where it's snowballed and it's, you know, very much hard to disentangle sort of what's signal and what's noise here. So anyways, that was a bit of a rambling disquisition. Feel free to direct me in a way that you'd want to pull the thread.
No, so I think you're right. They're like, no one really understands what is going on. So I guess my big question I want to kind of tackle at the start is, do you think that this is alien tech or is this domestic or foreign governments trying to just sow chaos? Because I look and like, again, we do have some military bases out in New York, New Jersey, but nothing super significant, correct? But the only significant thing that I can think of is that it's just a highly densely populated area that you could cause a lot of chaos and panic by continuing to do this. So I guess, what is your take on that?
Yeah, I think you have to go through sort of process of elimination in terms of laying out at least all the potential candidate hypotheses, right? And I guess, you know, the baseline is just, is it all entirely mass hysteria? Like mass hysteria. Are there actually no true objects that are other than helicopters and airplanes flying around? And again, you're always operating kind of probabilistically, but I've seen enough and I've talked to enough people inside, you know, the government that are seriously investigating this that it is not just that, right? It is not pure mass hysteria. It's not pure misidentification, right? There's a huge amount of that, right? But there is a core concrete set of activity, in the airspace that you just can't just be dismissed, as that. So they're sort of, okay, once you establish that as a foundational predicate, there is something that has to be explained here, right? It isn't just going to be entirely, sort of self-licking ice cream cone of, you know, kind of a social panic and mass, you know, misidentifications. Then you have to construct plausible explanations for what could, be the source of, you know, truly, unusual, sort of low flying, apparent objects, you know, with this kind of weird phenomenology of blinking lights, that seem to be able to hover for hours at a time, you know, in large numbers over, you know, essentially, you know, an entire state. So you have to account for these sorts of, you know, kind of frankly, kind of baffling, behaviors. And this is why people have grasped at a whole range of different things, right? So the one that was, I think, you know, easier to hand was that this is some sort of secret government operation, either to hunt down, you know, a suspected, you know, WMD attack, or it's some sort of super secret large scale test of such capabilities. You know, I would dismiss those two. We can get into why, but like, I don't think those are very plausible. The other candidate explanation is foreign adversaries, right? So China or Russia, you know, a congressman even, you know, claimed it was, and then retracted that it was some Iranian mothership, off the coast. You know, that was obviously quickly debunked as absurd. And I think even China or Russia, being responsible for this type of flight, is very, very unlikely. I think it actually is quite likely that, you know, China and Russia are conducting covert surveillance of military facilities, especially in Europe and other places around the world, using drones. So, you know, this has been quite well documented, and Russia in particular in Europe is, you know, looking to engage in a variety of sort of more, you know, sub-threshold kind of sabotage, activities, to mess with kind of NATO, sort of facilities in Europe. And China obviously has an aggressive domestic espionage capability to, you know, take a look at all of our sensitive facilities, right? So it stands to reason that they're going to be using a variety of different modalities, and UAS have been known for many, many years as a potent source of, as an intelligence, collection system. So that, you know, this has been built into the threat models for a lot of these facilities. But again, it doesn't necessarily explain what these particular objects are doing, right? These are not meant to be, these are not secret. These are not, going over the wire quickly and darting back and forth or planting a bug somewhere. These are just hovering for hours. They're not making a secret of their presence. This is not what you would do if you're conducting an espionage operation. So that at least I think we can safely dismiss. Could they be using it to conduct a psychological operation? Right. That seems to be like the, if I look at this behavior, it seems to, the Occam's razor for what it is, its intended effect seems to be psychological, right? Its intended effect seems to be exactly what's happening, which is to cause essentially a mass stir, and, you know, both undermine, sort of civic, confidence in the government, as well as to instill potentially a widening aperture of belief in the mass population about unusual things happening in the sky. And so there are a variety of, stakeholders, construed broadly that could have that as an objective for various reasons. But that seems to be like where I end up, as this seems to be, done for a psychological effect on a mass scale. And it's clearly not like a commercial entity. I know people were looking at, oh, this is some, small company doing a drone test. I do not think that explains the overflights over these military facilities where they're shutting down Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's not something that a commercial entity is going to be doing, let alone the numbers and sizes that you're seeing across such a wide area. Even it's the same thing with pranksters, right? You could always have probably pranksters in the mix that are looking to take advantage of the situation, get some notoriety. But again, I don't think that suffices to explain the breadth and scale of the observed activity. So then I think you're left kind of resolving to, okay, there's some, set of progenitor, groups that are like conducting this activity with the objective, in my mind, that seems to have like a psychological effect. And there, I think, it could be, there's two basic categories, right? There's some human group that has that objective, and there's non-human groups that would have that objective, right? And so this is where, the conversation is then overlaps with the larger sort of UAP related conversation. That's kind of where I think then we're left. Maybe, we kind of have to pause, right? Cause we don't really have sufficient information to resolve it, I think, either way. But the fact that's been going on, persistently, not just this particular flap in New Jersey, but these repeated incursions over sensitive military facilities overseas and in the U.S., and that, I know, the folks at the FBI, for example, that are responsible for counter drone and counter WMD are completely in the dark. Working with the Coast Guard to, board, Chinese flagged vessels off the coast of New Jersey just because they think maybe it's being launched from there. Like, it just gives you a hint that I think they just don't really have a clue. It's possible some people in the government know, and it's possible that they're just not telling other people, especially their higher ups, what's really going on. That wouldn't surprise me. There's larger, threads in the UAP related conversation that, point in that direction, on that larger set of issues. I would also note the fact that, we're in this particularly fraught political moment domestically as we sort of head into the presidential transition. All of these things are hyper politicized. I'll just note that last point is, the incoming national security advisor for Trump, Waltz, he was taking it very seriously and was not dismissing it at all. And so I think it will be an area of focus for the incoming administration. I think these flaps, they tend to peak and then they tend to go away. And so like my baseline expectation is that, these sightings will just sort of fade away, and people will go, that was a weird thing that happened. Politicians will still quietly demand answers, but, everyone, I think, at a certain level would love for this to stop happening, and they could just kind of move on. And so every day that it doesn't, right, is a problem for that strategy. I think it's just in a wait and see mode. I guess I would sort of expect the next move from the White House to sort of deploy a sort of token set of more advanced systems. You know, they say they authorize the DoD to deploy, you know, whatever whiz bang stuff that they can make a show of pushing out there and, you know, claim that they're responding to local concerns and, you know, essentially keep kicking the can via actions like that while really not ultimately, coming up with any real solid explanation for what's happening.
So you don't think that it is alien technology that's doing this. And it sounds like you believe that it's probably domestic. I just want to make sure we're following the same.
No, I have no way right now of deciding between either of those hypotheses. I don't give, you know, one more or less weight than the other. I think, yeah, we just don't know, right? I think on the separate UAP side, I think it is quite likely, very likely, in fact, that the U.S. government has knowledge of and possession of, you know, what they call technologies of unknown origin and related materials. And they've had those in their possession for many decades, and they've been, you know, they've been the subject of intense, very, very, very secret research. And this has been a sort of a sub rosa Cold War arms race between the U.S. and Russia, and more recently China. And so there is, you know, a subplot to all of this, which is the ongoing degree to which the U.S. government is taking, you know, this topic of, you know, UAPs and non-human intelligence extremely seriously. And that the incoming administration also takes it extremely seriously. So I, you know, on that separate thread, I think there's a large body of reason to believe that there are phenomena that we can't conventionally explain, and that the incoming administration is going to be putting in place mechanisms to bring some of this information out to the public in a more controlled fashion. I do not know, though, to the extent to which that whole subplot intersects with this New Jersey stuff, right? So, like, I could hold the propositions to be true, both that non-human intelligence is real, non-human intelligence is here. We have possession of some of their technology, and senior officials in the U.S. government that are unelected are aware of that fact, and the incoming administration is increasingly aware of it as well. I could hold that is all true, and that these New Jersey sightings are complete, conventional, normal, you know, social panic fictions, right? Like those could both be true things, right? And so I need to find some harder evidence to stitch them together. And, you know, you look at some of these observed activity over New Jersey, and they're not obviously, anomalous in the same way that the U.S. government has defined UAPs as sort of, characterized by a number of specific observables, right? So like, sort of non-inertial flight, advanced propulsion, hypersonic speeds, transmedium travel, low observability, and even sort of biological and psychological effects on close observers. So these are the characteristic, you know, observables, the phenomenologies associated with UAPs that have driven all of that, you know, separate thread of government research and now maybe more official, quote, disclosure activities. None of the New Jersey things seem to very clearly fit that description. You obviously have some low observability, but none of the things that I've seen are like, you know, hypersonic or transmedium, et cetera. They certainly are able to have long loiter times that seem to exceed the performance envelope of, you know, most known kind of drone platforms, but not so dramatically exceed those. They're certainly more than like typical, you know, commercial, like private drone, capabilities, but, you know, they're not doing anything too crazy. So I don't know if there's really good evidence right now to directly connect the New Jersey sightings to the separate thread of activity that the U.S. government has been engaged on UAPs. But the fact that, you know, they have ruled out officially, you know, a foreign nexus and, you know, private entities and U.S. government, official involvement, you know, it's like, it leaves that blank space unfilled though, right? So I don't think you can rule it out, but I don't think there's very strong evidence pointing in its direction either. So we're just left in this very, ambiguous zone right now, right? And, yeah, I think the New Jersey incidents are certainly very interesting and very important because they've brought kind of this idea of anomalous things happening in the air to kind of the public attention in a way that none of the, like, the quote, like, you know, core UAP related events, and news has, right? So, like, this is on the Sunday morning news shows. People are being interviewed about it. Like, CNN's doing hits. People, you know, local mayors and the governor and the Senate are all doing press conferences. And this is, you know, a matter of acute political attention here, right? And so I think it's important to maybe, you know, leverage that attention to steer folks in the direction of things that maybe haven't gotten as much attention, which is exactly what is the U.S. government and Congress been doing about this issue of, you know, quote, non-human intelligence, and what processes are being put into place to bring some of that information out to the public. That I think will be a focus in 2025. There are, you know, many, many senior officials inside the incoming cabinet for Trump that know a lot about this issue, that are very focused on it, that have a priority, that are making it a priority. And so, yeah, this could all, you know, the New Jersey thing could go away and be conventionally explained, but I think this issue of UAPs is not going to go away.
So you believe that they're going to release documents or evidence showing kind of the programs they've been denying?
I don't know exactly to what extent they're going to release information. I think there's an active debate underway over what's the right strategy to take. You know, you could categorize it essentially as one strategy is what you could say is like is a slow disclosure where the government acts as if it's all true, and starts doing things to expand the security enclave that's historically been placed around these programs to bring in additional, you know, talent, you could say, and to sort of put in place mechanisms and formal structures that broaden awareness of historic exotic technology antecedents. That's kind of the language in legislation. Without actually really ever or anytime immediately, you know, just coming out and saying declaratively, the U.S. government knows that these objects are, you know, of non-human origin, right? So that sort of slow disclosure is the sort of do things in a very ambiguous fashion where you have to be taking, you have to be paying very close attention, and it will look very odd, but there'll be sort of plausible deniabilities, sort of build the ambiguity. Like, is this really being done as some sort of ruse? Is this some sort of smokescreen for some secret technology program? Is this just a head fake, you know, for China? Like, what's really going on? And that, you know, you could imagine that sort of, period of ambiguity and tension going on for quite a while the government officially brings more people in, right? And broadens awareness of these programs as I think is the objective. And then, you know, that's like phase one. And then phase two is that ultimately that's not a permanent strategy, right? That just buys you some period of time to try to grease the skids or foam the runway, to a certain extent. And then there's another strategy or, you know, potential approach, which is much more, you know, overt, which is, yes, like start with a hard declaration of some basic facts, that then you try to hold the line on. So you just say, yep, non-human intelligence is real. And, you know, these things are not, phantasms. These are not, social fictions. This is entirely a psychological operation to cover advanced, conventional programs. And, you know, we will put in place official mechanisms to try to bring this information out to the public, you know, in a way that doesn't create economic and political disruption. So that is a active area of, let's say, analysis, because there's no consensus, I think, right? The government is lots of different parts and pieces, both in and out of the government, you know, between Congress and the executive. The policy of the Biden administration was no disclosure whatsoever. Jake Sullivan just didn't want to deal with it and didn't think, you know, necessarily President Biden was in a position to have this conversation with the American public. So it was just a matter of kicking the can progressively down the road. It's my understanding the Trump administration is of a different view and has put in place folks like Rubio at State Department, like Ratcliffe at CIA, Tulsi at DNI, the incoming National Security Advisor, Waltz. Obviously, RFK Jr. is very interested in this. Vivek is very interested in this. So you have a wide swath of kind of the core power players on the security apparatus that are very focused on this. I mean, even J.D. Vance has given statements on the subject. If you listen to what Trump has said in various interviews, he said some very curious things, including in his Rogan interview, where he unprompted referred to the, quote, people coming from space, and how he's been briefed a lot on that subject. So yeah, this is going
to
be...
Who was that on Rogan?
Yeah, most people didn't pick up on it. You know, it is what it is. But yeah, if you go to, if you look at the Rogan interview that Trump did, and there's a, you know, you can find the clip. I don't know where it is, but they were talking about the JFK assassination, and you know, essentially Rogan was sort of trying to, you know, tug on the thread of, you know, would Trump disclose the information the government has about that assassination that has not been released yet. And how many people are interested in that subject. And unprompted, so Rogan didn't bring up UAPs. And, you know, in the transition, Trump led the transition of that conversation to many people are also interested in, and he looked up at the ceiling, the people coming from space. And then Rogan, you know, followed up, which was, essentially like, do you know a lot about that? Or like, have you been told about that? And Trump replied, I know a lot about that, and had a very sort of, you know, serious look on his face. And, yeah, then the conversation continued for a few, like a minute or two about that. So I encourage folks to study that clip.
yeah, absolutely. You know, I had missed that. So I'm going to go back after this and see if I can find it and dive into it some more. That's very interesting.
Yeah, so this is where the New Jersey stuff is an interesting story, but it's somewhat frustrating because, you know, it's all cell phone videos and firsthand accounts of weird stuff, and most of it's misidentifications, but there's like real things happening over military facilities that are hard to explain. That could be a mix of both foreign adversaries opportunistically taking advantage of the chaos, as well as, you know, potentially non-human origin groups sending a signal, right? And this is characteristic, been observed over many, many decades, right? You can look at official FOIA documents from Strategic Missile Command and like dozens of incidents over our military facility, over our nuclear missile sort of assets of local security forces observing, you know, essentially orbs or colored lights, even like using the characteristic sort of red and green blinking lights coming over sensitive military facilities or nuclear missile silos. Even disrupting the performance of those missile silos, like turning them off, that happened at Malmstrom Air Force Base. An entire missile wing went offline in the 60s. And these are recurring pattern of objects that are clearly anomalous. You know, taking a special interest in our nuclear capabilities, making their presence very known. Although they also demonstrate an interesting phenomenon, which is when, you know, fighter jets or helicopters get scrambled to try to intercept them, they go dark and disappear. And I thought it was interesting that the Governor Murphy of New Jersey reported being told something very similar from his local law enforcement, that whenever they try to, you know, get close to these in a helicopter or whatever, that they go dark, quote. So who knows? Could just be a coincidence, but that pattern of sort of these red and green blinking lights, had been seen as, you know, far back as the 60s and 70s in official U.S. military, sort of site reports of these encounters and, you know, with dozens of witnesses, security forces, local observers. One case I think was in Cheyenne, Wyoming. You know, obviously we have a lot of, you know, nuclear missile silos out there. This occurred over the period of weeks, and you had, you know, three rounds of sightings, with dozens of witnesses seeing dozens of objects, with a similar phenomenology to the ones that you could, you know, that folks are pointing to, in New Jersey. So, you know, hard to, you know, come to a super high degree of confidence about what's really going on. But if you just look at the historical record of these sorts of, UAP related flaps, they tend to have a strong nexus to our nuclear facilities, our military facilities. They've been well documented over decades. They've been the subject of, you know, official derision and taboo as a policy of the U.S. government, dating back to the 1950s, because they, you know, they don't want to have to explain what's going on. I think that's understandable. But now you're in this modern era of social media and cell phones and actual drones. And now when you have a similar phenomenon take place, it's like, this is what I would expect. It would be mixed in with a whole bunch of other chaos and noise and disinformation and misinformation that it's, you know, impossible to really nail down. And so that's where we are right now.
Well, I have to say, I think I have more questions than I did at the beginning of the show with all this, Matthew. There's so much going on and so much to dissect. It's crazy. I could spend the whole show. I could spend hours talking to you about this, but we are the Bitcoin veterans. So I want to make sure we spend a little bit of time with some of your work, at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. So I'm just going to open up to the panel really quick. Yomar, Bob, or AC, do you guys have any questions you want to ask about the drones or the UAP phenomenon, or do you want to start diving into, some of the other stuff? I'm going to take your silence as a no. So just really quick, I want to give a thank you to our partners, Black Sheep Ammo. Restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com. Punch Plate, stamp your seed phrase on a metal plate. Check them out at punchplate.com. Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms and tactical training at paladintowertactics.com. And Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. Use the code BTCVETS with an S for 5% off. And if you pay your order in Bitcoin, you can get an additional 10% off. So potential for 15% off your order, solosatoshi.com. And Bitcoin Alaska, July 5th and 6th in Juneau. It's going to be a phenomenal conference. This will be the only conference where if you purchase a whale pass, you'll get to go on the private tour up Tracy Arm Fjord and you will see whales. So you buy a whale pass, you'll most likely see whales at this conference. It's family friendly. Bring your spouse, bring your kids, bring your family. It'll be amazing. Check it out at bitcoinalaska.org. So Matthew, I want to kind of dive into, kind of what you've been doing at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. How motivated or pumped are you all for the Trump administration coming in? And then I definitely want to spend some time on, the strategic Bitcoin reserve. And I know that you typed up, kind of like a draft or a letter to Bissonnette to kind of look over. So, if you want to start off with any of those.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, the TLDR is, incoming Trump administration will be, I think more pro Bitcoin than even, you know, the median Bitcoiner is assessing. I was in Abu Dhabi for Bitcoin MENA, had a keynote and then did a panel and had a number of, meetings while I was there. There were folks from the Trump, sort of camp, on the ground, in a number of meetings with government officials from countries in the region, and the subject of Bitcoin was obviously the primary discussion topic, specifically whether countries should pursue a strategy of acquiring Bitcoin as part of their national assets, in concert with maybe other pro-Bitcoin related policies like Bitcoin mining. A number of those countries have already moved pretty dramatically into Bitcoin mining as an industry, but the, you know, that in some countries is a lower threshold, that they've already cleared before thinking about acquiring Bitcoin as an asset for their national balance sheet.
And, can I ask you if you're able to discuss which countries you were talking with, like what representatives from the countries?
I don't think I can say specific countries, but there are a limited number of Gulf Cooperation Council countries, that you would like, if you ranked them, you would, you know, think about the top four or five countries there. And so those were all very, having very frank and, practical discussions about what that would look like. And then sending messages back to their national leadership, within minutes of the conversation on what they would be doing next. And so, yeah, this is a very serious conversation, right? These were, officials that had the ear of their national leadership, and they were sent there to get, an assessment of what the Trump administration and what the U.S. more broadly may be doing, in a Bitcoin direction, and wanted to ensure that they were, on the right side of things, and that they were, doing what was necessary for their own country's interests as well. So yeah, that was a Bitcoin conference. It was almost like a diplomatic, conference between folks from the U.S. side and some folks from the region with sort of Bitcoin, in the middle. So that was, quite an eye-opening, few days for me, just serious number of countries were looking at this. I also had talked with folks that were there who were going over to India, that are very close to the national leadership of India, and were carrying a similar message. I know folks that were also then traveling to Hong Kong within days of that meeting, and you know, precipitating similar, you know, initial discussions on Hong Kong in particular changing its or pivoting pretty dramatically towards Bitcoin, and you know, even subtle intimations that the mainland itself may be shifting its Bitcoin policy in the next year or so. So, you know, these were all preparatory discussions. These were all, you know, folks feeling each other out. So no hard, you know, declarations of policy change or specific actions. But the vibe, and the very, you know, serious inclination was in a particular direction. And yes. And so I think that is then also, you know, being driven by a recognition that the U.S. government, incoming Secretary Bessent, and, you know, other officials in the government, but Bessent is obviously, I think, the most important, when it comes to, you know, economic and sort of financial policy, that the U.S. government is going to be taking a very pro-Bitcoin policy stance, and that, the establishment of a strategic Bitcoin reserve, at least, you know, as a matter of signaling, is very likely, very early on in the U.S. administration. And so that, you know, that is, you know, I think you saw the tweet from Senator Lummis, where she had a meeting with Bessent, and so that I think is a very positive, you know, sign of his feelings towards Bitcoin. You know, she has a very particular policy objective that she has in mind. So, yeah, I you know, again, you never know until you know what's actually going to happen. But I would expect pretty dramatic changes to be taking place in the U.S. government's official stance towards Bitcoin in 2025 that will likely be reflected in and precipitate similar official shifts by a number of other countries, especially in the Middle East, potentially in Asia as well.
So I want to make sure that people are aware of this. You wrote a memo for Scott Bessent, correct? And you passed it along to his team, I guess. Do you know if he read it or not?
So we haven't shared the full memo. It's going through final editing. It's like 50 pages now. And we haven't shared it with anyone, on the Trump side. The larger question of, analysis of a strategic Bitcoin reserve and the question of what U.S. Bitcoin policy, you know, implications of that for geopolitics, like BPI has produced a number of papers on that subject in the past. I think those have, you know, certainly gone into different parts of the Trump administration and even the Harris administration over the summer. When, you know, these were meant to be public reports. So, yeah, we're not doing any sort of covert you know, messaging. This is when I read this memo, that will be published and it will be public. And you know, it'll be intended for him, but it will, you know, it'll have a broader authorship. And, you know, just to kind of preview it, essentially, you know, what I'm expecting, and this is just me reading a variety of different tea leaves, is that, you know, the Scott Bessent will be steering a pretty dramatic set of, you might call it, geoeconomic policy shifts in 2025. I think they have something sketched out. Of course, you know, plans don't often survive first contact with reality. So, you know, we'll see like what manifests over the course of the year, but I think they have, at least as a strategic objective, to try to reset a whole bunch of different terms of the geoeconomic and monetary order that they view as no longer being in U.S. government's interest. And so this, you know, is a combination of both like the tariff, sort of economic and currency, you know, quote, war that they might be declaring on a variety of different countries. But I think it's a larger vision of making more explicit the terms of what you would call like the imperial dollar system, which is an imperial system, right? That essentially the U.S. government provides a public good to the world in the sense of a security zone, and they you know the folks inside the Trump administration feel like the costs of providing that public good are being disproportionately borne by America, both in terms of our actual taxpayer expenditures on defense, as well as the fact that we have to run structural deficits as part of our role in a very structurally imbalanced global trade system where China's mercantilism has essentially stolen our industrial capacity, or we willingly gave it up to them, essentially, depending on who you talk to. And that they want to, sort of try to put, not flip that overnight, but sort of put in place mechanisms to try to stop that trajectory. And that may involve a number of things, right? Where if the world essentially is, or parts of the world are more implicitly behind a U.S. security zone, that they might make that more explicit. And that might mean that, essentially erecting what you could imagine, tech tariff and trade wall, kind of a club. And there's, certain conditions on being a member of that club where you effectively have to subsidize the imperial core, right? These sorts of systems, when they reach a certain stage, the imperial core usually never, first tries to impose financial repression on its citizens, right? It tries to, make the periphery pay. And that's what I would expect, is that we will try to make the periphery pay, in various ways to essentially subsidize the provision of the security zone. And we will use a variety of sort of carrots and sticks, right? Sort of threats of tariffs, as well as potential threats of export controls and restrictions of access to our leading technology, right? For example, our frontier AI models, and maybe more explicit threats of withholding security protection. So a very high risk maneuver, in a sense. Bluffs could be called in a variety of different regions around the world. But I think there's this vision of creating a much more explicit kind of geoeconomic zone where there's, countries are bucketed into certain categories of like, if you're fully inside the zone, right, you get access to all these benefits, but you have to pay, right? And if you're not inside that zone, well, there's going to be, potential costs and there's going to be enemies essentially, or rivals, that are explicitly targeted, with tools of statecraft. And so I'm still trying to situate Bitcoin as part of, if they're envisioning these sorts of integrated measures of statecraft to, wield geopolitical and monetary carrots and sticks, currency war, tech war, export controls, to try to reset the structure of the global trade system, the monetary system, in a way that they feel like is more aligned to U.S. national security interests, where would Bitcoin fit in? Right to that, right? So, to what extent would the concept of a strategic Bitcoin reserve align with a version of that strategy? Or more generally, right, what would a pro-Bitcoin policy stance mean for the U.S. government attempting to, marginally shift the structure of the global monetary system? Which, if you look in history, right, these things tend to happen in a bit of a shock. Right, like the Nixon shock, the monetary system is usually downstream of the geopolitical system, and usually major changes don't happen unless there's a major geopolitical event like a world war, or the endogenous stress is, builds up in such a way that political leaders decide that they're just going to flip the table, right? Which is what Nixon did with his coterie at Camp David, right?
Yeah, I think I just want to jump in quick before I lose. Yeah. My memory is not great, so I will forget things quickly. So I just want to jump in quick. So one of the first things I wanted to ask, this is going back a little bit, but, do you think that how much of the Bitcoin support that you're seeing or that, you're expecting from the upcoming Trump administration, how much of that do you think will spill into like shit coins, and how much of the messaging is just teaching them that there's a distinct difference between Bitcoin and whatever token they think is the same thing. Is there a lot of effort going in that direction, or is it hey, we'll take the bucket and then let nature do its course to sift out the garbage?
It's a good question. I think it's tough. It's all very, very much personnel based. And I think you're seeing on the broader crypto side, they have a voice, right? They also got a lot of political pull as a result of, their efforts in the election campaign. And so that's resulting in, personnel appointments and a voice, at the leadership level. And, you know, so I would expect they're going to get some, you know, they're going to get some things, right? Whether it's the CFTC, the SEC stuff, you know, legislative action, stable coins, market structure bill, you know, et cetera. And a much more favorable kind of regulatory environment, right? So that I think is like, that should be the baseline. I know a lot of, you know, our work at BPI is very much focused on trying to, you know, focus on these strategic level questions of Bitcoin's role, and alignment with national security and our geopolitical interests over the next 5, 10, 15 years, right? So if Bitcoin is on this trajectory to monetize, to reach potential, meaningful parity or a substantial fraction of gold, right? That's going to have, you know, that's going to be much more important sort of geoeconomic, development than, you know, Coinbase's ability to list, you know, another token, right? Like those are just different categories of questions. And, you know, there's going to be a whole cottage industry of folks that are, you know, wanting to get the personnel in place to ensure that there's a regulatory framework for those tokens to be listed. And, you know, that's a separate policy area. I don't see it as actually that relevant to this larger question of if Bitcoin is going to, become a geopolitically relevant asset, that multiple countries and trillions of dollars of sovereign wealth funds and potentially even national balance sheets are diversified into, that's going to raise a much larger set of questions, than the SEC or even the CFTC, have to deal with, right? That's where the Treasury Secretary, the Department of Defense and the White House are much more critical stakeholders. So yeah, I think there'll be different lanes here. And I think you're going to see Bitcoin maybe potentially carve out its own lane in this more strategic level discussion because it doesn't necessarily have the same level of regulatory, issues that the much larger digital assets industry has.
Okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And then for the other stuff you're talking about, you know, it's interesting to hear like the plans of like a new kind of system for, you know, with like the periphery you said, like subsidizing the imperial core. You know, like I think that they're, you mentioned like wars or like world wars often a lot of times how like these like hegemons kind of shift out of like the sole global hegemon into, you know, something different or like somebody else takes the role. You know, I think that this is something that's necessary, you know, like I think the way I look at it is like either we can, you know, move with the flow or we can like fight against it and it's going to go a lot worse. Right. So I think if we, you know, use like some of these systems that you mentioned to kind of go with the flow of like where the world is tracking anyway, I think it'll be a lot better for the United States and for Americans in general than like fighting against it and trying to uphold what is there now with like our, you know, the massive military, system that we have, all of the costs that it's associated with it, you know, like the debt and the monetary policies that go along with that. To me, that doesn't seem sustainable. So it's good to hear that, like, that there is some, thoughts of like what could come next. You know, to me, it's just necessary. Like we can't keep, subsidizing, you know, we even get mocked by a lot of these countries that talk about like their free healthcare and stuff, whereas they don't have a defense system because we are their defense system, you know, and you got people here, you know, struggling with various, internal things. So it'd be interesting to see like those kind of play out. So, glad to hear about, those plans being thought of as well.
Yeah, I think there's no one weird trick that's just going to fix all this stuff, right? Like, and I think even some of their policy objectives are somewhat in tension with each other, right? You know, reviving the domestic, you know, manufacturing base, you know, tariffs, like these things are going to have like potentially countervailing effects on the strength of the dollar and global capital flows. And it's going to be, you know, I think it's going to require, you know, someone like Bessent to try to like, you know, navigate, kind of the, like through the needle, right? Of how to balance a number of these different competing priorities and, you know, interagency constituencies. And of course having Trump, at the top who just wants to get, you know, who wants to see success, right? Like, and that's going to be the interesting question for me is going to be the path dependency in the first, you know, 6 to 12 months, right? What gets done first? How much, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, some things are going to have costs. You know, when you're trying to shift a system like this, it's about imposing pain on different pools of capital, right? Effectively, right? Like you're going to have, maybe more explicit or implicit, yield curve control / financial repression. The question is that how much can you impose that on your rivals? How much can you impose that on your allies and partners? How much do you have to impose upon your domestic economy? And then within your domestic economy, you know, how do you distribute those costs, right? So at the end of the day, right, there's a lot of different tools that you can wield, but it's a political and geopolitical question of how do you wield those tools in a way that, in the ideal world maximizes the pain on your rivals. And then, you know, in a differential gradient, ideally gives, benefits to your domestic political constituencies. And that's a tough thing, right? Because the adversary gets a vote and they can counter. And China is a very strong, has their own tools, to deploy. And so, you know, the U.S. goes in a certain direction. It'd be interesting to see how does China respond? How much of this is done in an explicit adversarial manner versus, does Trump try to, do a deal, right? Bring China into some sort of new accord, right? Some sort of, managed set of devaluations and agreements on capital controls and trade. But usually before you get a deal, you have to ante up. You have to sort of peacock. So it's interesting. Obviously I thought it was interesting that Trump invited Xi to his inauguration, right? Like he's clearly not beholden to, certain bromides in the sort of beltway, NatSec and sort of statecraft conversation. So the possibility of things coming out of kind of the Overton window, is much higher than, I think a Harris administration, would see. But yeah, I'm just as curious as everybody else is to see how they're going to sequence some of these policy shifts. To what extent will, these bluffs be called, or will they be backed up with, hard action? And then it's a geopolitical and political question of statecraft. How do you make sure that China pays and not Japan? Or how do you make if Japan's and Taiwan is going to pay that it's not U.S., U.S. bondholders or U.S., equity holders, or if it is U.S. equity holders and bondholders, that it isn't, the middle class, right? So these are, there is a tiered structure of sort of, pools of capital and constituencies that are going to be affected by any such set of shifts. And they all get a vote in our decision making. So I don't have a crystal ball about exactly how it will play out, but that will be the main game in the next 12 months.
Hey, Matthew, we're at the top of the hour here. I want to be respectful of your time. Can we keep you for a couple more minutes?
Yeah, I've got about 10 minutes.
Okay, then I'll go ahead and wrap it up with this. So there's been a lot of talk over the weekend. There was a video of Jack Mahler's on Tim Pool's podcast where he leaked that he's heard reports or he knows that Trump is going to sign an executive order for a strategic Bitcoin reserve on day one. I guess my first question would be, have you heard the similar rumors of that happening? And what are the immediate after effects if Trump does it on day one? Like how quickly does FOMO kick in for every other country?
Yeah, so I've done I've done some research back in the summer about how the president could draft an executive order to establish something like a strategic Bitcoin reserve. So just like mechanically, you could sort of think about it in two ways, right? One is just like the signaling objective, and the second would be a actual acquisition objective, right? So if you just try to zoom in on how an executive order could be structured to do those two things, in the former case, it's pretty simple. It's effectively just drawing an official box around the U.S. Marshal Service's current holdings. And essentially declaring those to be the U.S. government's strategic Bitcoin reserve and announcing an intent, not to sell them. And then instructing, say, the Treasury Department to, study maybe, more formal, sort of program, structures for custody and maybe, proof of reserves and that sort of thing, right? So sort of get in motion some of the institutional and bureaucratic mechanisms that maybe the U.S. Marshal Service, wouldn't be in a position to provide, right? But sort of that would be sort of step one. That could be done very simply, right? Three pages, right? That's signed on day one. That's very feasible. very doable, and wouldn't require any additional funding, right? It's essentially just, to a certain extent, like a declaration of intent, right? So I would say that is a very likely thing to occur. It could occur literally on day one, right? There's not much that would have to be done, right? You know, sort of mechanically or structurally to make that happen. The second piece, though, right, which is the U.S. government adding to that stockpile or add to that reserve holding. That's more non-trivial, right? And so there are, though, existing authorities. For example, the Gold Reserve Act of 1934 gives the Treasury Secretary, as delegated by the President, authority to, in order to, quote, stabilize the dollar, although that's somewhat been weakened as language, but effectively gives the Treasury Secretary access to effectively a slush fund. It's called the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And to purchase and sell assets, including gold, foreign exchange, and other instrument of credit and securities. And so that is the key kind of legislative kind of crux, is to what extent Bitcoin fits into that definition. So it's obviously not gold. You know, you could make a potential argument that it is foreign exchange, although if you actually look into, you know, legislative definitions of foreign exchange, essentially it's foreign issued currency. You could say El Salvador has made Bitcoin legal tender, but it's not necessarily a foreign currency in the sense that it's issued by a sovereign. So that'd be it'd be feasible potentially, but it could be litigated, and that may not be the strongest leg to stand on is to claim that Bitcoin is foreign currency under the saturated definitions. That are in precedent. And so then that leaves, if you're going to use the Exchange Stabilization Fund to purchase additional Bitcoin into the strategic national stockpile of Bitcoin, then you would need to find a way of structuring the transaction in a way that it would fit the third clause, which is other instruments of credit and securities. And it seems pretty, you know, simple to structure such a transaction. And you could imagine going to a custodian or, you know, an exchange or a miner or whoever that has Bitcoin and essentially structure like an overnight note that is paid out in Bitcoin, right? So this government, you know, essentially agrees to purchase this note. And it has a, you know, it's redeemable the next day and it's paid out in Bitcoin. And so that is technically a, you know, instrument of credit and security. The government is taking on some settlement risk overnight. But there's nothing I think that would restrict the U.S. government from acquiring Bitcoin using that type of structure. So there's a certain limited amount of funds in the Exchange Stabilization Fund that would be available for this. It changes, you know, but we're not talking like tens of billions of dollars, maybe at the top end, 5, 10, 15 billion, but that seems still a bit exaggerated. I don't know. Mechanically, right? Those funds are in current, you know, existing foreign exchange. A large portion of it's tied up in special drawing rights for the IMF. So there's probably a limited amount of additional, you know, say spare change in the ESF that could be used to buy Bitcoin. You know, could buy, you know, a few billion dollars of the Bitcoin as a material amount, but it would still, I think, you know, from a strategic perspective, amount to just like an emphasis of the signal, right? Emphasis of the U.S. government essentially is very serious about Bitcoin, is very serious about holding it as part of their national sort of assets. And then that would have basically, you know, sort of exhaust the executive's authority and funding, right, for establishing and building something like a strategic Bitcoin reserve. And then all of the more relevant discussion would then go over to the Congress, right? They have the power of the purse, and this would have to be a serious debate inside the Senate first, and then in the House, as to if they were going to formally establish in law what the president has created by executive mandate, and if they are going to establish it in law, what is the sort of the larger program that they're going to potentially support and fund? And so this is the Lummis bill that has sort of set the initial marker, but I know there's a lot of discussion likely, you know, happening now and will continue to take place between her and her colleagues on this bill, which, you know, is called the Bitcoin Act. And in her initial drafting, it's essentially a million Bitcoin over 5 years. It, you know, that's gets acquired, 200,000 a year, et cetera, with a purchase program, a whole bunch of requirements for security and custody, and auditing, et cetera. And so that is, like, I don't know how to handicap the Senate on that side. I think we'll come down to how much of a priority the president makes this after he establishes, you know, his own Bitcoin reserve. Like, to what extent does he feel that this needs to be codified in law? You know, do they really want to grow it the way that the Senator Lummis wants to grow it? To what size? You know, what do her colleagues think about this? What does the House think about this? Like, this is a very much an open question. And so I think that will be, you know, that will continue to evolve and, you know, could change, you know, pretty dramatically from where it is now, both up, you know, up and down. And I think a lot of it's going to be dictated by what happens on the international stage as a result of Trump potentially establishing this, you know, by executive order. Like, what is this trigger in the Gulf countries? What is this trigger in Hong Kong, or other places? And does that change the political debate inside the Senate? You know, these things could start off being kind of dismissed or not taken seriously as a policy priority, and then it could become a significant priority. So we'll see. But I think that's the way I would sort of think about it in sort of the sequence here. Likely going to get something like a declaration of intent, right? EO, you know, the mechanics of establishing, or adding to it via, the ESF. You know, that might take time because, you know, if I was Secretary of Defense, right, I'd want to be in office. I want to be confirmed. I want to have my people there. I'd want to get my own people to sort of study the mechanics of this, you know, before the president just sort of issues this instruction, right? So you could see, you know, these things kind of take place in a sequence. But I think, yeah, as of now, the trajectory is towards, you know, the U.S. government, you know, making a very clear shift in a pro Bitcoin way, and then we'll just see how far it goes, or what else, you know. Crisis happens all the time, and political tension can be distracted. So if there's going to be major moves, I would expect them to take place, you know, in the first year.
Well, that's awesome. I really appreciate that. I know we're out of time here, so I want to thank you so much. This was last minute, so I want to thank you so much for joining us, talking about all this and answering our questions. Where's the best place we can point people to help what you're doing?
Well, yeah. So certainly, if you're multinational and you've got China hacking you, you know, hit me up. It's my day job as director of intelligence at Pinnacle One. If you're interested in Bitcoin policy, you know, certainly Bitcoin Policy Institute, I think we're carving out a niche for ourselves as a sort of Bitcoin focused, research, and advocacy group inside DC. And I think we're poised to have a voice, in these discussions. So we always look to have people contribute, either financially to the organization or in your own way, if you've got a certain professional background, a perspective, whether it's in international finance, in national security, in climate, energy, and human rights. These are a lot of the focus areas of research by the fellows at BPI. So we're always on the lookout for really interesting, you know, folks that have professional backgrounds and interest in writing about or studying Bitcoin or contributing to the policy discussion there. So hit me up on that. Obviously David Zell and Grant McCarty are the co-founders, and we've built like a pretty impressive stable of fellows, producing really high quality research across all those different fronts. So, you know, it's an open game. So feel free to jump in and play.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much. I wish you the best of luck and a very Merry Christmas. And, we need to get you back on the show because I only scratched off two of my talking points. So there's still a ton of stuff I'd like to dive in with you. So we'll have to get together maybe in the new year.
Yeah, anytime. Happy holidays, everybody.
Yeah, thank you so much, Matthew. And again, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I know we had some technical issues at the start of the show. We had a couple spaces links, some were broken. So I do appreciate everybody who tuned in, everyone who listened, everyone who retweeted it, and to everyone who just had us on the background to drown out the voices in your head, or if you have family coming in for the holidays, drowning out your in-laws. So we'll be doing this for the rest of the week, and then we'll have kind of a weird schedule next week during the Christmas break. So just stay tuned for that. Tomorrow night on the Bitcoin video podcast, we have Jack Donovan, the author of The Way of Men, joining us. So that'll be a great one to tune into, 7 p.m. Eastern time. Make sure we set our alarms and reminders for that one. But that's all I have for you. Go out there. Like Donald Trump says, have fun playing with your Bitcoins. But again, remember, when you're talking about it with friends, Bitcoin's at an all-time high again. They're not going to remember what you say. They're going to remember the way you say it. So make sure that we come as great ambassadors to Bitcoin and steer everybody away from all the other noise. And yes, that means shitcoins. So don't shitcoin. It's like bringing a knife to a gunfight, but it's only a butter knife. That's it. Enjoy your day. I'll see y'all tomorrow morning.